entire city's worth of crime all at once, he realized he was seeing everything from a completely new perspective. "It poses the question, why?" he said. "What are the underlying causes of why there is a certain cluster of crime in a particular place?" The problem was, at the time, every call to the police was being treated as an isolated incident. If you rang to report an aggressive group of drug dealers who were hanging out on a corner, but they ducked out of sight as soon as the cops arrived, nothing would be recorded that could link your complaint to other emergency calls made once the gang retook their positions. By contrast, Maple's maps meant that he could pinpoint precisely where crime was a chronic problem, and that meant he could start to pick apart the causes. "Is there a shopping center here?" he told his interviewer. "Is that why we have a lot of pickpockets and robberies? Is there a school here? Is that why we have a problem at 3 o'clock? Is there an abandoned house nearby? Is that why there is crack dealing on the corner?" Being able to answer these questions was the first step towards tackling the city's problems. So in 1990, when the open-minded Bill Bratton became head of the New York Transit Police, Maple showed him his charts of the future. Together, they used them to try and make the subway a safer place for everyone. Bratton had a clever idea of his own. He knew that people begging, urinating, and jumping the turnstiles were a big problem on the subway. He decided to focus police attention on addressing those minor misdemeanors rather than the much more serious crimes of robbery and murder that were also at epidemic levels below ground. The logic was twofold. First, by being tough on any antisocial behavior at the crime hotspots, you could send a strong signal that criminal activity was not acceptable in any form, and so hopefully start changing what people saw as normal. Second, that people evading fares were disproportionately likely to be criminals who would then go on to commit bigger crimes. If they were arrested for fare evasion, they wouldn't have that chance. "By cracking down on fare evasion, we have been able to stop serious criminals carrying weapons at the turnstiles before they get on the subways and wreak havoc," Bratton told Newsday in 1991. The strategy worked. As the policing got smarter, the subways got safer. Between 1990 and 1992, Maple's maps and Bratton's tactics cut felonies on the subway by 27% and robberies by a third. When Bratton became police commissioner for the New York Police Department, he decided to bring Maple's charts of the future with him. There they were developed and refined to become CompStat, a data tracking tool that is now used by many police departments, both in the United States and abroad. At its core remains Jack Maple's simple principle: record where crimes have taken place to highlight where the worst hotspots are in a city. Those hotspots tend to be quite focused. In Boston, for instance, a study that took place over a 28-year period found that 66% of all street robberies happened on just 8% of streets. Another study mapped 300,000 emergency calls to police in Minneapolis. Half of them came from just 3% of the city area. But those hotspots don't stay the same over time. They constantly move around, subtly shifting and morphing like drops of oil on water, even from one day to the next. And when Bratton moved to Los Angeles in 2002, he began to wonder if there were other patterns that could tell you when crime was going to occur, as well as where. Was there a way to look beyond crimes that had already happened? Rather than just responding to crime, the source of Maple's frustration, or fighting it as it happened, could you also predict it? The flag and the boost. When it comes to predicting crime, burglary is a good place to start. Because burglaries take place at an address, you know precisely where they happened, unlike pickpocketing, say. After all, it's quite possible that a victim wouldn't notice their phone missing until they got home. Most people will report if they've been burgled too, so we have really good, rich data sets, which are much harder to gather for drug-related offences, for instance. Plus, people often have a good idea of when their homes were burgled, perhaps when they were at work or out for the evening. Information you won't have for crimes such as vandalism. burglars also have something in common with the serial murders and rapists that Rosmo studied. They tend to prefer sticking to areas they're familiar with. We now know that you're more likely to be burgled if you live on a street that a burglar regularly uses, say on their way to work or school. We also know that there's a sweet spot for how busy burglars like a street to be. They tend to avoid roads with lots of traffic, yet home in on streets with lots of carefree non-locals walking around to act as cover. As long as there aren't also lots of nosy locals hanging about acting as guardians. But that's only the first two components to the appeal of your home to a burglar. Yes, there are factors that don't change over time, like where you live or how busy your road is, that will flag the steady appeal of your property as a target. But before you rush off to sell your house and move to a quiet cul-de-sac with a great neighbourhood watch scheme, you should also be aware that crime hotspots don't stay still. The second component of your home's appeal is arguably the more important. This factor depends on what exactly is going on right now in your immediate local neighbourhood. It's known as the boost. If you've ever been broken into twice within a short space of time, you'll be all too familiar with the boost effect. As police will tell you after you've first been victimised, criminals tend to repeatedly target the same location. And that means that no matter where you live, you're most at risk in the days right after you've just been burgled. In fact, your chances of being targeted can increase 12-fold at this time. There are a few reasons why burglars might decide to return to your house. Perhaps they've got to know its layout or where you keep your valuables. Things like TVs and computers are often replaced pretty quickly too. Or the locks on your doors, or the local escape routes. Or it might be that they spotted a big ticket item they couldn't carry the first time round. Whatever the reason, this boost effect doesn't just apply to you. Researchers have found that the chances of your neighbours being burgled immediately after you will also be boosted, as will those of your neighbour's neighbours, your neighbour's neighbour's neighbours, and so on, all the way down the street. You can imagine these boosts springing up and igniting across the city like a fireworks display. As you get further away from the original spark, the boost gets fainter and fainter, and it fades away over time too, until, after 2 months, unless a new crime reboosts the same street, it will have disappeared entirely. The flag and the boost in crime actually have a cousin in a natural phenomenon, earthquakes. True, you can't precisely predict where and when the first quake is going to hit, although you know that some places are more prone to them than others. But as soon as the first tremors start, you can talk quite sensibly about where and how often you expect the aftershocks to occur, with a risk that is highest at the site of the original quake, lessens as you get further away, and fades as time passes. It was under Bratton's direction that the connection between earthquake patterns and burglary was first made. Keen to find a way to forecast crimes, the Los Angeles Police Department set up a partnership with a group of local mathematicians at the University of California, Los Angeles, and let them dig through all the data the cops could lay their hands on, 13 million crime incidents over 80 years. Although criminologists had known about the flag and the boost for a few years by this point, in searching through the patterns in the data, the UCLA group became the first to realize that the mathematical equations which so beautifully predicted the risk of seismic shocks and aftershocks could also be used to predict crimes and aftercrimes. And it didn't just work for burglary. Here was a way to forecast everything from car theft to violence and vandalism. The implications were indeed seismic. Rather than being able to say that a recently victimized area of the city was vaguely more at risk, with these equations, you could quantify exactly what that risk was down to the level of a single street. And knowing, probabilistically speaking, that a particular area of the city would be the focus of burglars on a given night, it was easy to write an algorithm that could tell the police where to target their attention. And so Predpol, or predictive policing, was born. The crime tipster. You might well have come across Predpol already. It's been the subject of thousands of news articles since its launch in 2011, usually under a headline referencing the Tom Cruise film Minority Report. It's become like the Kim Kardashian of algorithms. Extremely famous, heavily criticised in the media, but without anyone really understanding what it does. So before you fill your mind with images of seers lying in pools of water, screaming out their premonitions, let me just manage your expectations slightly. Predpol doesn't track down people before they commit crimes. It can't target individual people at all, only geography. And I know I've been throwing the word prediction around, but the algorithm can't actually tell the future. It's not a crystal ball. It can only predict the risk of future crimes, not the events themselves. And that's a subtle but important difference. Think of the algorithm as something like a bookie. If a big group of police officers are crowded around a map of the city, placing bets on where the crime will happen that night, Predpol calculates the odds. It acts like a tipster, highlighting the streets and areas that are that evening's favourites in the form of little red squares on a map. The key question is whether following the tipster's favourites can pay off. To test the algorithm's prowess, it was pitted against the very best expert human crime analysts in two separate experiments, one in Kent in southern England, the other in the southwest division of Los Angeles. The test was a straight head-to-head challenge. All the algorithm and the expert had to do was place 20 squares, each representing an area of 150 square meters, on a map to indicate where they thought most crime would happen in the next 12 hours. Before we get to the results, it's important to emphasise just how tricky this is. If you or I were given the same task, assuming we don't have extensive knowledge of the Kentish or Californian crime landscapes, we'd probably do no better than chucking the squares onto the map at random. They'd cover pathetically little of it, mind, just 1/1000th of the total area in the case of Kent, and every 12 hours you'd have to clear your previous guesses and start all over again. With this random scattering, we could expect to successfully predict less than 1 in 100 crimes. The experts did a lot better than that. In LA, the analysts managed to correctly predict where 2.1% of crime would happen, and the UK experts did better still with an average of 5.4%, a score that was especially impressive when you consider that their map was roughly 10 times the size of the LA one. But the algorithm eclipsed everyone. In LA, it correctly forecast more than double the number of crimes that the humans had managed to predict. And at one stage in the UK test, almost 1 in 5 crimes occurred within the red squares laid down by the mathematics. Predpol isn't a crystal ball, but nothing in history has been able to see into the future of crime so successfully. Putting predictions into practice. But there's a problem. While the algorithm is relatively great at predicting where crime will happen over the next 12 hours, the police themselves have a subtly different objective, reducing crime over the next 12 hours. Once the algorithm has given you its predictions, it's not entirely clear what should be done next. There are a few options, of course. You could set up CCTV cameras or undercover police officers and catch your criminals in the act. But perhaps it would be better for everyone if your efforts went into preventing crime before it happened. After all, what would you prefer? Being the victim of a crime where the perpetrator gets caught, or not being the victim of a crime in the first place? In the case of burglary, you could warn local residents that their properties are at risk, maybe offer to improve the locks on their doors, maybe install burglar alarms or timers on their light switches to trick any dodgy people passing by into thinking there's someone at home. That's what one study did in Manchester in 2012, where they managed to reduce the number of burglaries by more than a quarter. Small downside, though, the researchers calculated that this tactic of so-called target hardening costs about £3,925 per burglary it prevents. Try selling that to the Los Angeles Police Department, which deals with over 15,000 burglaries a year. Another option which deviates as little as possible from traditional policing is a tactic known as cops on the dots. In the olden days, Steve Colgan, a retired Metropolitan Police officer, told me, patrols were just geographic. You got the map, cut it up into chunks and divvied it up. You're on that beat, you're on that beat, as simple as that. Problem was, as one UK study calculated, a police officer patrolling their randomly assigned beat on foot could expect to come within 100 yards of a burglary just once every 8 years. With cops on the dots, you simply send your patrols to the hotspots highlighted by the algorithm instead. It should be called cops on the hotspots, really. I guess that wasn't as catchy. The idea being, of course, that if the police are as visible as possible and in the right place at the right time, they're more likely to stop crime from happening or at least respond quickly in the immediate aftermath. This is exactly what happened in Kent. During the second phase of the study, as the evening shift started, the sergeant printed off the maps with red squares highlighting the at-risk areas for that evening. Whenever the police on patrol had a quieter moment, they were to go to their nearest red box, get out of their cars, and have a walk around. On one particular evening in an area they would never normally go to, police found an East European woman and her child in the street. It turned out that the woman was in an abusive relationship, and just minutes before, the child had been sexually assaulted. The sergeant on duty that night confirmed that they found these people because they were in a predpol box. The suspect was arrested nearby later that night. The mother and the child weren't the only people helped by the algorithm during the cops on the dots trial. Crime in Kent overall went down by 4%. Similar studies in the United States, conducted by Predpol itself, report even bigger drops in crime. In the Foothill area of Los Angeles, crime dropped by 13% in the first 4 months of using the algorithm, despite an increase of 0.4% in the rest of the city, where they were relying on more traditional policing methods. And Alhambra, a city in California not far from LA, reported an extraordinary 32% drop in burglaries and a 20% drop in vehicle theft after deploying the algorithm in January 2013. These numbers are impressive, but it's actually difficult to know for sure whether Predpol can take the credit. Toby Davies, a mathematician and crime scientist from UCL, told me, "It's possible that merely encouraging police officers to go to places and get out of their cars and walk around, regardless of where they are, actually could lead to reductions in crime anyway." And there's another issue here. If the harder you look for crime, the more likely you are to find it, then the act of sending police out could actually change the crime records themselves. When police are in a place, Davies told me, they detect more crime than they would have done otherwise. Even if an equal value of crime is happening in two places, the police will detect more in the place they were than the one they weren't. That means there is a very big downside of using a cops on the dots tactic. By sending police into an area to fight crime on the back of the algorithm's predictions, you can risk getting into a feedback loop. If, say, a poorer neighbourhood had a high level of crime in the first instance, the algorithm may well predict that more crime will happen there in the future. As a result, officers are sent to the neighbourhood, which means they detect more crime. Thus, the algorithm predicts more still, more officers are sent there, and so on it goes. These feedback loops are more likely to be a problem for crimes that are linked to poorer areas, such as begging, vagrancy, and low-level drug use. In the UK, where some sections of society regularly complain about a lack of police presence on the streets, focusing police attention on certain areas might not immediately seem unfair. But not everyone has a positive relationship with the police. It is legitimate for people who see a police officer walking in front of their house every day to feel oppressed by that, even if no one's doing any crimes, even if that officer is literally just walking up and down, Davies told me. You almost have a right not to be constantly under pressure under the eye of the police. And I'm rather inclined to agree. Now, a well-tuned algorithm should be built so that it can take account of the tactics being used by the police. There are ways, theoretically at least, to ensure that the algorithm doesn't disproportionately target particular neighbourhoods, like randomly sending police to medium-risk areas as well as high-risk ones. But unfortunately, there's no way to know for sure whether Predpol is managing to avoid these feedback loops entirely, or indeed whether it's operating fairly more generally, because Predpol is a proprietary algorithm. The code isn't available to the public, and no one knows exactly how it works. Predpol is not the only software on the market. One competitor is HunchLab, which works by combining all sorts of statistics about an area, reported crimes, emergency calls, census data, as well as more eyebrow-raising metrics like moon phases. HunchLab doesn't have an underlying theory. It doesn't attempt to establish why crime occurs in some areas more than others. It simply reports on patterns it finds in the data. As a result, it can reliably predict more types of crime than Predpol, which has at its heart theories about how criminals create geographical patterns. But because HunchLab 2 is protected as intellectual property, it is virtually impossible from the outside to ensure that it isn't inadvertently discriminating against certain groups of people. Another opaque predictive algorithm is the strategic subject list used by the Chicago Police Department. This algorithm takes an entirely different approach from the others. Rather than focusing on geography, it tries to predict which individuals will be involved in gun crime. Using a variety of factors, it creates a heat list of people it deems most likely to be involved in gun violence in the near future, either doing the shooting or being shot. The theory is sound. Today's victims are often tomorrow's perpetrators, and the program is well-intentioned. Officers visit people on the watch list to offer access to intervention programs and help to turn their lives around. But there are concerns that the strategic subject list might not be living up to its promise. One recent investigation by the non-profit RAND Corporation concluded that appearing on it actually made no difference to an individual's likelihood of being involved in a shooting. It did, however, mean they were more likely to be arrested. Perhaps, the report concluded, this was because officers were simply treating the watch list as a list of suspects whenever a shooting occurred. Predictive policing algorithms undoubtedly show promise, and the people responsible for creating them are undoubtedly doing so in good faith with good intentions. But the concerns raised around bias and discrimination are legitimate. And for me, these questions are too fundamental to a just society for us simply to accept assurances that law enforcement agencies will use them in a fair way. It's one of many examples of how badly we need independent experts and a regulatory body to ensure that the good an algorithm does outweighs the harm. And the potential harms go beyond prediction. As we have already seen in a variety of other examples, there is a real danger that algorithms can add an air of authority to an incorrect result. And the consequences here can be dramatic. Just because the computer says something doesn't make it so. Who do you think you are? Steve Talley was at home in South Denver in 2014 when he heard a knock at the door. He opened it to find a man apologizing for accidentally hitting his car. The stranger asked Talley to step outside and take a look. He obliged. As he crouched down to assess the damage to his driver's side door, a flash grenade went off. Three men dressed in black jackets and helmets appeared and knocked him to the ground. One man stood on his face. Another restrained his arms, while another started repeatedly hitting him with the butt of a gun. Talley's injuries would be extensive. By the end of the evening, he had sustained nerve damage, blood clots, and a broken penis. "I didn't even know you could break a penis," he later told a journalist at The Intercept. "At one point, I was actually screaming for the police. Then I realized these were cops who were beating me up." Steve Talley was being arrested for two local bank robberies. During the second robbery, a police officer had been assaulted, which is why, Talley thinks, he was treated so brutally during his arrest. "I told them they were crazy," he remembers shouting at the officers. "You've got the wrong guy." Talley wasn't lying. His arrest was the result of his striking resemblance to the right guy, the real robber. Although it was a maintenance man working in Talley's building who initially tipped off the police after seeing photos on the local news, it would eventually be an FBI expert using facial recognition software who later examined the CCTV footage and concluded that the questioned individual depicted appears to be Talley. Talley had a cast-iron alibi, but thanks to the FBI expert's testimony, it would still take over a year to clear his name entirely. In that time, he was held in a maximum security pod for almost 2 months until enough evidence surfaced to release him. As a result, he was unable to work, and by the time his ordeal was over, he had lost his job, his home, and access to his children, all as a direct result of that false identification. Seeing double. Facial recognition algorithms are becoming commonplace in modern policing. These algorithms, presented with a photograph, footage, or snapshot from a 3D camera, will detect a face, measure its characteristics, and compare them to a database of known faces with the aim of determining the identity of the person pictured. In Berlin, facial recognition algorithms capable of identifying known terrorism suspects are trained on the crowds that pass through railway stations. In the United States, these algorithms have led to more than 4,000 arrests since 2010, just for fraud and identity theft in the state of New York alone. And in the UK, cameras mounted on vehicles that look like souped-up Google Street View cars now drive around automatically cross-checking our likenesses with a database of wanted people. These vans scored their first success in June 2017 after one drove past a man in South Wales where police had a warrant out for his arrest. Our safety and security often depend on our ability to identify and recognize faces. But leaving that task in the hands of humans can be risky. Take passport officers, for instance. In one recent study set to mimic an airport security environment, these professional face recognizers failed to spot a person carrying the wrong ID a staggering 14% of the time, and incorrectly rejected 6% of perfectly valid matches. I don't know about you, but I find those figures more than a little disconcerting when you consider the number of people passing through Heathrow every day. As we shall see, facial recognition algorithms can certainly do better at the task than humans. But as they're applied to hunt for criminals, where the consequences of misidentification are so serious, their use raises an important question. Just how easily could one person's identity be confused with another's? How many of us have a Steve Talley-style lookalike lurking out there somewhere? One study from 2015 seems to suggest the chances of your having your own real-life doppelganger, whether they're a bank robber or otherwise, are vanishingly small. Tegan Lucas at the University of Adelaide painstakingly took 8 facial measurements from photographs of 4,000 people and failed to find a single match among them, leading her to conclude that the chances of 2 people having exactly the same face were less than 1 in a trillion. By that calculation, Talley wasn't just a bit unlucky. Taking into account his particular 1 in a trillion evil twin also lived nearby and happened to be a criminal, we could expect it to be tens of thousands of years before another ill-fated soul fell foul of the same miserable experience. And yet, there are reasons to suspect that those numbers don't quite add up. While it's certainly difficult to imagine meeting someone with the same face as yourself, anecdotal evidence of unrelated twin strangers does appear to be more common than Lucas's research might suggest. Take Neil Douglas, who was boarding a plane to Ireland when he realized his double was sitting in his seat. The selfie they took with a plane load of passengers laughing along in the background quickly went viral, and soon redheads with beards from across the world were sending in photos of their own to demonstrate that they too shared the likeness. "I think there was a small army of us at some point," Neil told the BBC. "I even have my own story to add to the pile. When I was 22, a friend showed me a photo they'd seen on a local band's MySpace page. It was a collage of pictures taken at a gig that I hadn't attended, showing a number of people all enjoying themselves, one of whom looked eerily familiar. Just to be sure I hadn't unwittingly blacked out one night and wandered off to a party I now had no recollection of attending, I emailed the lead singer in the band, who confirmed what I suspected. My synth-pop-loving doppelganger had a better social life than me." So that's Tally, Douglas and me, who each have at least one doppelganger of our own, possibly more. We're up to 3 in a population of 7.5 billion, and we haven't even started counting in earnest. We're already way above Lucas's estimate of 1 in a trillion. There's a reason for the discrepancy. It all comes down to the researcher's definition of identical. Lucas's study required that two people's measurements must match one another exactly. Even though Neil and his lookalike are incredibly similar, if one nostril or one earlobe were out by so much as a millimeter, they wouldn't strictly count as doppelgangers according to her criteria. But even when you're comparing two images of the same person, exact measurements won't reflect how each one of us is continually changing through aging, illness, tiredness, the expressions we're pulling, or how our faces are distorted by a camera angle. Try to capture the essence of a face in millimeters, and you'll find as much variation in one person's face as you will between people. Put simply, measurements alone can't distinguish one face from another. Although they might not be perfectly identical, I can nonetheless easily imagine mixing up Neil and his twin stranger in their photograph. Likewise, in the Tally case, poor Steve didn't even look that similar to the real robber, and yet the images were misinterpreted by FBI experts to the point where he was charged with a crime he didn't commit and thrown into a maximum security cell. As the passport officers demonstrated, it's astonishingly easy to confuse unfamiliar faces, even when they bear only a passing resemblance. It turns out that humans are astonishingly bad at recognizing faces. It's the reason why a friend of mine claimed she could barely sit through Christopher Nolan's beautifully made film Dunkirk, because she struggled to distinguish between the actors. It's why teenagers find it worthwhile to borrow an older friend's ID to buy alcohol. And it's why the Innocence Project, a non-profit legal organization in the United States, estimates that eyewitness misidentification plays a role in more than 70% of wrongful convictions. And yet, while an eyewitness might easily confuse Neil with his travel companion, his mother would surely have no problem picking out her son in the photo. When it comes to people we know, we are tremendously good at recognizing faces, even when it comes to real-life doppelgangers. A set of identical twins might be easily confused if they're only your acquaintances, but just as easily distinguished once you know them properly. And herein lies a critical point. Similarity is in the eye of the beholder. With no strict definition of similarity, you can't measure how different two faces are, and there is no threshold at which we can say that two faces are identical. You can't define what it means to be a doppelganger, or say how common a particular face is, nor, crucially, can you state a probability that two images were taken from the same individual. This means that facial recognition, as a method of identification, is not like DNA, which sits proudly on a robust statistical platform. When DNA testing is used in forensics, the profiling focuses on particular chunks of the genome that are known to be highly variable between humans. The extent of that variation is key. if the DNA sequence in a sample of body tissue found at the scene of a crime matches the sequence in a swab from a suspect, it means you can calculate the probability that both came from the same individual. It also means you can state the exact chance that some unlucky soul just happened to have an identical DNA sequence at those points. The more markers you use, the lower your chances of a mismatch. And so by choosing the number of markers to test, every judicial system in the world has complete power to decide on the threshold of doubt they're willing to tolerate. Even though our faces feel so intrinsically linked to who we are, without knowing the variation across humans, the practice of identifying felons by their faces isn't supported by rigorous science. When it comes to identifying people from photos, to quote a presentation given by an FBI forensics unit, lack of statistics means conclusions are ultimately opinion-based. Unfortunately, using algorithms to do our facial recognition for us does not solve this conundrum, which is one very good reason to exercise caution when using them to pinpoint criminals. Resemblance and identity are not the same thing and never will be, however accurate the algorithms become. And there's another good reason to tread carefully with facial recognition algorithms. They're not quite as good at recognizing faces as you might think. One in a million. The algorithms themselves work using one of two main approaches. The first kind builds a 3D model of your face, either by combining a series of 2D images or by scanning you using a special infrared camera. This is the method adopted by the Face ID system that Apple uses in its iPhones. These algorithms have worked out a way to get around the issues of different facial expressions and aging by focusing on areas of the face that have rigid tissue and bone, like the curve of your eye socket or the ridge of your nose. Apple has claimed that the chance of a random person being able to unlock your phone with Face ID is one in a million. But the algorithm is not flawless. It can be fooled by twins, siblings and children on their parents' phones. Soon after the launch of Face ID, a video appeared of a 10-year-old boy who could hoodwink the facial recognition on his mother's iPhone. She now deletes her texts if there's something she doesn't want her son to look at. There have also been reports that the algorithm can be tricked by a specially built 3D printed mask with infrared images glued on for the eyes. All this means that while the algorithm might be good enough to unlock your phone, it probably isn't yet reliable enough to be used to grant access to your bank accounts. Nor are these 3D algorithms much use for scanning passport photos or CCTV footage. For that, you need the second kind of algorithm, which sticks to 2D images and uses a statistical approach. These algorithms don't directly concern themselves with landmarks that you or I might recognize as distinguishing features, but instead build a statistical description of the patterns of light and dark across the image. Like the algorithms built to recognize dogs in the medicine chapter, recently researchers realized that rather than having to rely on humans to decide which patterns will work best, you can get the algorithm to learn the combinations for itself by using trial and error on a vast database of faces. Typically, it's done using neural networks. This kind of algorithm is where the big recent leaps forward in performance and accuracy have come in. That performance, though, comes with a cost. It isn't always clear precisely how the algorithm decides whether one face is like another. That means that these state-of-the-art algorithms can also be pretty easily fooled. Since they work by detecting a statistical description of the patterns of light and dark on a face, you can trick them just by wearing funky glasses with a disruptive pattern printed on them. Even better, by designing the specific disruptive pattern to signal someone else's face, you can actually make the algorithm think you are that person. In one famous example, scientists designed a pair of glasses that would make the wearer look like actress Mia Jovovich. using glasses as a disguise. Turns out Clark Kent was onto something. But targeted attacks with funky glasses aside, the recognition abilities of these statistical algorithms have prompted many admiring headlines, like those that greeted Google's FaceNet. To test its recognition skills, FaceNet was asked to identify 5,000 images of celebrities' faces. Human recognizers had previously attempted the same task and done exceptionally well, scoring 97.5% correct. Unsurprisingly, since these celebrity faces would have been familiar to the participants. But FaceNet did even better, scoring a phenomenal 99.6% correct. On the surface, this looks as if the machines have mastered superhuman recognition skills. It sounds like a great result, arguably good enough to justify the algorithms being used to identify criminals. But there's a catch. 5,000 faces is, in fact, a pathetically small number to test your algorithm on. If it's going to be put to work fighting crime, it's going to need to find one face among millions, not thousands. That's because the UK police now hold a database of 19 million images of our faces, created from all those photos taken of individuals arrested on suspicion of having committed a crime. The FBI, meanwhile, has a database of 411 million images, in which half of all American adults are reportedly pictured. And in China, where the ID card database gives easy access to billions of faces, the authorities have already invested heavily in facial recognition. There are cameras installed in streets, subways and airports that will supposedly spot everything from wanted criminals to jaywalkers as they travel through the country's cities. There's even a suggestion that a citizen's minor misdemeanors in the physical world, like littering, will form part of their Sesame credit score, attracting all of the associated punishments that we uncovered in the data chapter. Here's the problem. The chances of misidentification multiply dramatically with the number of faces in the pile. The more faces an algorithm searches through, the more chance it has of finding two faces that look similar. So once you try using the same algorithm on bigger catalogues of faces, their accuracy plummets. It would be a bit like getting me to match ID cards to 10 strangers and, when I got full marks, claiming that I was capable of correctly identifying faces 100% of the time, then letting me wander off into the centre of New York to identify known criminals. It's inevitable that that accuracy would drop. It's just the same with algorithms. In 2015, the University of Washington set up the so-called MegaFace Challenge, in which people from around the world were invited to test their recognition algorithms on a database of 1 million faces, still substantially smaller than the catalogues held by some government authorities, but getting closer. Even so, the algorithms didn't handle the challenge well. Google's FaceNet, which had been close to perfect on the celebrities, could suddenly only manage a 75% identification rate. Other algorithms came in at a frankly pathetic 10% success rate. At the time of writing, the world's best is a Chinese offering called Tencent Youtu Lab, which can manage an 83.29% recognition rate. To put that another way, if you're searching for a particular criminal in a digital lineup of millions, based on those numbers, the best case scenario is that you won't find the right person 1 in 6 times. Now, I should add that progress in this area is happening quickly. Accuracy rates are increasing steadily, and no one can say for certain what will happen in the coming years or months. But I can tell you that differences in lighting, pose, image quality, and general appearance make accurately and reliably recognizing faces a very tricky problem indeed. We are some way away from getting perfect accuracy on databases of 411 million faces, or being able to find that 1 in a trillion doppelganger match. Striking a balance. These are sobering facts, but not necessarily deal breakers. There are algorithms good enough to be used in some situations. In Ontario, Canada, for instance, people with a gambling addiction can voluntarily place themselves on a list that bars them from entering a casino. If they resolve waivers, their face will be flagged by recognition algorithms, prompting casino staff to politely ask them to leave. The system is certainly unfair on all those mistakenly prevented from a fun night on the roulette table, but I'd argue that's a price worth paying if it means helping a recovering gambling addict to resist the temptation of their old ways. Likewise in retail. In-store security guards used to have offices plastered with Polaroids of shoplifters. Now algorithms can cross-reference your face with a database of known thieves as soon as you pass the threshold of the store. If your face matches that of a well-known culprit, an alert is sent to the smartphones of the guards on duty, who can then hunt you out among the aisles. There's good reason for stores to want to use this kind of technology. An estimated 3.6 million offences of retail crime are committed every year in the UK alone, costing retailers a staggering £660 million. And when you consider that in 2016, there were 91 violent deaths of shoplifting suspects at retail locations in the United States, there is an argument that a method of preventing persistent offenders from entering a store before a situation escalates would be good for everyone. But this high-tech solution to shoplifting comes with downsides. Privacy, for one thing. Face First, one of the leading suppliers of this kind of security software, claims it doesn't store the images of regular customers, but shops are certainly using facial recognition to track our spending habits. And then there's the question of who ends up on the digital blacklist. How do you know that everyone on the list is there for the right reasons? What about innocent until proved guilty? What about people who end up on the list accidentally? How do they get themselves off it? Plus, again, there's the potential for misidentification by an algorithm that can never be perfectly accurate. The question is whether the pros outweigh the cons, and there's no easy answer. Even retailers don't agree. Some are enthusiastically adopting the technology, while others are moving away from it, including Walmart, which cancelled a Face First trial in their stores after it failed to offer the return on investment the company were hoping for. But in the case of crime, the balance of harm and good feels a lot more clear-cut. True, these algorithms aren't alone in their slightly shaky statistical foundations. Fingerprinting has no known error rate either, nor do bite mark analysis, blood splatter patterning, or ballistics. In fact, according to a 2009 paper by the US National Academy of Sciences, none of the techniques of forensic science, apart from DNA testing, can demonstrate a connection between evidence and a specific individual or source. Nonetheless, no one can deny that they have all proved to be incredibly valuable police tools, just as long as the evidence they generate isn't relied on too heavily. But the accuracy rates of even the most sophisticated facial recognition algorithms leave a lot to be desired. There's an argument that if there is even a slight risk of more cases like Steve Talley, then a technology that isn't perfect shouldn't be used to assist in robbing someone of their freedom. The only problem is that stories like Talley don't quite paint the entire picture. Because while there are enormous downsides to using facial recognition to catch criminals, there are also gigantic upsides. The tricky trade-off. In May 2015, a man ran through the streets of Manhattan randomly attacking passers-by with a black claw hammer. First, he ran up to a group of people near the Empire State Building and smashed a 20-year-old man in the back of the head. 6 hours later, he headed south to Union Square and, using the same hammer, attacked a woman quietly sitting on a park bench on the side of the head. Just a few minutes later, he appeared again, this time targeting a 33-year-old woman walking down the street outside the park. Using surveillance footage from the attacks, a facial recognition algorithm was able to identify him as David Barrell, a man who, months before the attacks, had posted a picture on Instagram of a hammer dripping with blood. He pleaded guilty to the charges stemming from the attacks and was sentenced to 22 years in prison. Cold cases too are being reignited by facial recognition breakthroughs. In 2014, an algorithm brought to justice an American man who'd been living as a fugitive under a fake name for 15 years. Neil Stammer had absconded while on bail for charges, including child sex abuse and kidnapping. He was rearrested when his FBI wanted poster was checked against a database of passports and found to match a person living in Nepal whose passport photo carried a different name. After the summer of 2017, when 8 people died in the terrorist attacks on London Bridge, I can appreciate how helpful a system that used such an algorithm might be. Yusuf Zagbar was one of the 3 men who drove a van into pedestrians before launching into a stabbing spree in neighbouring Borough Market. He was on a watch list for terrorist suspects in Italy and could have been automatically identified by a facial recognition algorithm before he entered the country. But how do you decide on that tricky trade-off between privacy and protection, fairness and safety? How many Steve Tallies are we willing to accept in exchange for quickly identifying people like David Barrell and Yusuf Zagbar? Take a look at the statistics provided by the NYPD. In 2015, it reported successfully identifying 1,700 suspects, leading to 900 arrests, while mismatching 5 individuals. Troubling as each and every one of those 5 is, the question remains, is that an acceptable ratio? Is that a price we're willing to pay to reduce crime? As it turns out, algorithms without downsides, like Kim Rossmo's geoprofiling discussed at the beginning of the chapter, are the exception rather than the rule. When it comes to fighting crime, every way you turn, you'll find algorithms that show great promise in one regard, but can be deeply worrying in another. Predpol, HunchLab, strategic subject lists and facial recognition, all promising to solve all our problems, all creating new ones along the way. To my mind, the urgent need for algorithmic regulation is never louder or clearer than in the case of crime, where the very existence of these systems raises serious questions without easy answers. Somehow, we're going to have to confront these difficult dilemmas. Should we insist on only accepting algorithms that we can understand or look inside, knowing that taking them out of the hands of the proprietors might mean they're less effective and crime rates rise? Do we dismiss any mathematical system with built-in biases or proven capability of error, knowing that in doing so, we'd be holding our algorithms to a higher standard than the human system we're left with? And how biased is too biased? At what point do you prioritize the victims of preventable crimes over the victims of the algorithm? In part, this comes down to deciding, as a society, what we think success looks like. What is our priority? Is it keeping crime as low as possible, or preserving the freedom of the innocent above all else? How much of one would you sacrifice for the sake of the other? Gary Marks, professor of sociology at MIT, put the dilemma well in an interview he gave to The Guardian. The Soviet Union had remarkably little street crime when they were at their worst of their totalitarian, authoritarian controls. But my God, at what price? It may well be that in the end, we decide that there should be some limits to the algorithm's reach, that some things should not be analysed and calculated. That might be a sentiment that eventually applies beyond the world of crime, not perhaps for lack of trying by the algorithms themselves, but because, just maybe, there are some things that lie beyond the scope of the dispassionate machine. Chapter 7, Art. Justin was in a reflective mood. On the 4th of February 2018, in the living room of his home in Memphis, Tennessee, he sat watching the Super Bowl, eating M&Ms. Earlier that week, he'd celebrated his 37th birthday, and now, as had become an annual tradition, he was brooding over what his life had become. He knew he should be grateful, really. He had a perfectly comfortable life, a stable 9-to-5 office job, a roof over his head, and a family who loved him. But he'd always wanted something more. Growing up, he'd always believed he was destined for fame and fortune. So how had he ended up being so normal? It was that boy band, he thought to himself, the one he'd joined at 14. If we'd been a hit, everything would have been different. But for whatever reason, the band was a flop. Success had never quite happened for poor old Justin Timberlake. Despondent, he opened another beer and imagined what might have been. On the screen, the Super Bowl commercials came to an end. Music started up for the big halftime show, and in a parallel universe, virtually identical to this one, in all but one detail, another 37-year-old Justin Timberlake from Memphis took to the stage. Many worlds. Why is the real Justin Timberlake so successful? And why did the other Justin Timberlake fail? Some people, my 14-year-old self included, might argue that real Justin's success is deserved. His natural talent, his good looks, his dancing abilities, and the artistic merit of his music made fame inevitable. But others might disagree. Perhaps, they'd claim, there is nothing particularly special about Timberlake or any of the other pop superstars who are worshipped by legions of fans. Finding talented people who can sing and dance is easy. The stars are just the ones who got lucky. There's no way to know for sure, of course, not without building a series of identical parallel worlds, releasing Timberlake into each and watching all the incarnations evolve to see if he manages success every time. Unfortunately, creating an artificial multiverse is beyond most of us. But if you set your sights below Timberlake and consider less well-known musicians instead, it is still possible to explore the relative roles of luck and talent in the popularity of a hit record. This was precisely the idea behind a famous experiment conducted by Matthew Salganik, Peter Dodds, and Duncan Watts back in 2006 that created a series of digital worlds. The scientists built their own online music player, like a very crude version of Spotify, and filtered visitors off into a series of 8 parallel musical websites, each identically seeded with the same 48 songs by undiscovered artists. In what became known as the Music Lab, a total of 14,341 music fans were invited to log on to the player, listen to clips of each track, rate the songs, and download the music they liked best. Just as on the real Spotify, visitors could see at a glance what music other people in their world were listening to. Alongside the artist name and song title, participants saw a running total of how many times the track had already been downloaded within their world. All the counters started off at 0. And over time, as the numbers changed, the most popular songs in each of the 8 parallel charts gradually became clear. Meanwhile, to get some natural measure of the true popularity of the records, the team also built a control world where visitors' choices couldn't be influenced by others. There, the songs would appear in a random order on the page, either in a grid or a list, but the download statistics were shielded from view. The results were intriguing. All the worlds agreed that some songs were clear duds. Other songs were standout winners. They ended up being popular in every world, even the one where visitors couldn't see the number of downloads. But in between surefire hits and absolute bombs, the artists could experience pretty much any level of success. Take 52 Metro, a Milwaukee punk band whose song Lockdown was wildly popular in one world, where it finished up at the very top of the chart, and yet completely bombed in another world, ranked 40th out of 48 tracks. Exactly the same song, up against exactly the same list of other songs, it was just that in this particular world, 52 Metro never caught on. Success, sometimes, was a matter of luck. Although the path to the top wasn't set in stone, the researchers found that visitors were much more likely to download tracks if they knew they were liked by others. If a middling song got to the top of the charts early on by chance, its popularity could snowball. More downloads led to more downloads. Perceived popularity became real popularity, so the eventual success was just randomness magnified over time. There was a reason for these results. It's a phenomenon known to psychologists as social proof. Whenever we haven't got enough information to make decisions for ourselves, we have a habit of copying the behavior of those around us. It's why theaters sometimes secretly plant people in the audience